say the game is getting old. Monday morning and your coffee's cold. Life is not what.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A New Direction. My name's Jay Izzo, and oh man, do we have another great show for you. It's so easy every week. I get a great author who writes a great book. My job's easy. I just get to ask the questions, and they just get to just give you and deliver just incredible information. This week is no exception. In fact, this week is phenomenal. Scott Edinger is going to be joining me here. You can see him on the screen if you're watching us live. The Growth Leader is the name of the book. Strategy to Drive the Top and Bottom Lines. Wall Street bestseller, USA bestseller. Absolutely, fundamentally, practically a game changer for every business, every level. Don't care if it's corporate, don't care if it's small. Everything that he says in here, everything, I'm not making this up, everything that he says in here applies. He makes a caution, CEOs, C-suite people, if you buy this, don't buy this for like your sales team or your sales manager. You read it. Don't just buy it because they need it. You need it, okay? Here's the deal, folks. You probably have a business strategy out there. Good for you. Do you really know what it is? Probably not. At least that's what the statistics say. Does the rest of the company know your sales strategy? Probably not, because that's what the statistics say. And how about your salespeople? Is it in alignment? I mean, do they know? Do they understand that what's happening there between sales and you there? Is it antagonistic, right? Do you don't even know if they exist, or are you just out there hammering away? Sell. Oh boy, we got work to do, don't we? Well, that's why he wrote this book, because he's gonna help you do the work that you need to be doing now, okay? Don't wait, he's gonna do it. It's absolutely phenomenal. And I wanna introduce you to him right now, because he is phenomenal. His name's Scott K. Edinger. He's recognized as an expert in the intersection of leadership strategy and sales. His clients are in the Fortune 50 and across the globe, and those people across the globe trust him as their premier consultant, advisor, speaker for leading business growth. Scott works with CEOs and senior leaders to develop pragmatic approaches to drive top and bottom line results. He is the best-selling author of 3 books and over 100 articles in Forbes and Harvard Business Review, among other prominent publications. This book here, The Growth Leader, I already said it, but it's a Wall Street Journal USA Today bestseller. Guy, I mean, come on. His Harvard Business Review article, by the way, he wrote, look it up. It's called Making Yourself Indispensable. It's already being called a classic in the making. Scott's work has been published in a Harvard Business Review Guide to Your Professional Growth and Harvard Business Review Guide to Being More Productive. He served, by the way, this is so cool because we have this connection, Scott. He served as an affiliate faculty member for the University of North Carolina Keenan Flagler School of Business. I used to be on the Shark Tank for the senior projects. Oh. For the grad students. He received his Bachelor of Science in Communication in Rhetoric. Oh, by the way, you're gonna love the stuff he does with Aristotle. It's pretty cool. And at Florida FSU, big, huge FSU fan. He's extensive traveler, avid football fan, seen the Seminoles in 6 national championships. He's even sung with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, even though he's not part of that. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, welcome for the first time to A New Direction, Scott Edinger. Scott, welcome to A New Direction, brother.
Coach Jay, I'm thrilled to be here. And that introduction, I'm taking you everywhere with me. you're coming with me to every meeting I have to do the introduction. That was amazing. Thank you so much. By the way, you cannot foreshadow that I put stuff about Aristotle in The Growth Leader. Nobody's going to read that.
It's so good, though. It's so good what you did there.
Old model. It's an old formula.
I know, but when I went to grad school and I was doing philosophy of psychology, and we were doing, ethos, logos, and pathos, and studying that in psychology in grad school, it brought back memories. And then how you linked it up later with the 3 C's, beautiful stuff. Hopefully we'll get there. I think we will. Let's jump right in. Chapter 1, it's called The Hidden Differentiator. You say the sales organization is always naturally more distant from the C-suite than many other functions, but the sales function is also closest to the customer. This creates for us a disconnect, doesn't it? When we've got the C-suite here, and yet who's interacting with the customer here, there's not a connection that works very well, is there?
Yeah, that on the face of it, when you phrase it that way, people are like, huh, we kind of knew that. But when you say it that way, it's like the distance between C-suite and sales is the typically the greatest distance in an organization through a function. And then you put in place, well, sales is closest to the customer. Therefore, C-suite distant from the customer in a lot of ways, particularly even if it's not the customer, I'd say the prospects, the people who are not yet your customer, the people who you want to be your customer, your ideal client profile. Those are the ones you are distant from, and that's the danger sign.
You give us some statistics, one from McKinsey and Company and one from Gartner's research. And two numbers ring in my head, 25% and 53%.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the 25% of purchasing decisions is determined, this is the McKinsey study, by the overall sales experience, and 53% of return buyers is the sales experience. Let's put that together and give people a kind of why this is so important.
Well, if you think about buyer behavior and purchasing decisions, particularly in a B2B environment, though I have, since I wrote the book, I've had people send me tons of business to consumer research that says the same thing. That if the experience between the salesperson and the customer has anything to do with the decision, then that becomes an important factor. So the question is, well, how much of the decision is it? Is it incidental or significant? And it turns out that somewhere between a quarter and a half of the decision to do business with your company is dependent on the quality of that interaction. Mm-hmm. That now, again, assuming that there's some part of that interaction that's important. If not, you probably don't need a sales force. You can just have people buy from your website. Mm-hmm. But if you need anybody in a selling role that has an influence on the decision, either in what the customer buys, what kind of clients you're actively pursuing, whatever it is, if there is a human being there that is involved in that experience, then that person or persons are responsible for about a quarter to a half of the decision. Now, that is based on what happens before someone becomes a client. An interesting thing about those numbers, and I've seen them 25%, 39% is, you know, even greater than half, you know, more than the 53% study that I show. Well, if you think about that, those are all elements of the experience that occur before someone becomes a customer. So more than price alone, more than brand alone, more than service alone, and really second only to the stuff or the services that they're actually buying from you. So we don't think about the sales experience. It's sort of like, oh, we've got all these great things. Sales, just get out there and sell and tell them how great it is. Mm. And yet that part of the experience accounts for a great deal of the business that you win or lose.
The sales experience, I don't want us to overlook that too much, because you say something else here. You say the sales experience is a powerfully differentiating decision criterion that is routinely overlooked or dismissed outright.
Yeah.
This sales experience differentiates your company, and I added an exclamation point to it. And here's the thing. I think people will say, well, we give them service, but the sales experience is knowing the other side, the customer side. And I don't want to jump the gun too much here, but this is a differentiator for your business, is what kind of experience is that person getting from the first phone call? That's the differentiator.
So there's a way to think about this that I'd encourage everybody listening here. I suspect you've heard about CX, right? Customer experience. It's become very popular in the last decade. Every leader I talk with says, you know, one of the ways that we compete is on customer experience, which is great. But most CX efforts are focused on what happens after someone becomes a customer. Abuse, consistency of performance, service levels, and what's conspicuous by absence is what I refer to here as the sales experience, right? And if you think about CX and the customer journey, well, if the sales experience, that interaction with your company before I become a customer, if the sales experience is the first mile on that customer journey, well, then your prospects may get off at exit one if it's not a very good one, and they'll go have a customer experience with someone else. Because if it's focused only on pitches and telling and features and benefits and is absent insight, expertise, how do you think differently about your issues or with solutions that you might not have anticipated? If it doesn't have that kind of value in the experience, well, then I'm not too impressed with the walking, talking brochure. I'll go someplace else. Mm.
And this leads me to a measurement that I love that you brought up. Sales calls your customers would pay for is the subtitle.
Yeah.
And I just had a call with my coach, because coaches get coached, by the way. Just let everybody know they get coached.
Smart. Everybody should have one.
Yeah, I mean, they should.
The best coaches. Professionals in every business do, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, every sport. What sport doesn't have their own personal coaches? I played sports, so I mean, we always had coaches. So what's different in life? I don't know. In business, I don't know what's different. Yeah. Here's the thing. I was telling my coach today after reading this book, I said, here's my goal for being a coach, and here's the goal I have for you. I'm asking myself this question. Is this call a call I would pay for? Now, of course, I'm paying for it, right? But I want it to be, I want every interaction to be a call that I would pay for. Dig into that a little bit more, because that was a measurement that hit me really hard between the eyes.
Yeah. This idea comes from a former boss of mine, a mentor, a guy named Neil Rackham, who I worked with for years. And he used to ask us this question: would the customer, here's the you know, sort of litmus test on the whole thing. Would the customer write you a check for the sales call? Mm. Not the product, not the services that you're offering, the sales call, the sales experience, you know, write you a check for it. My response to that question was usually something along the lines of, you know, like, hey, boss, it's hard enough to just get them to write us a check for the services we're selling, let alone the whole sales call. But there is a very important and provocative point under that question, which is, how are you creating value in the sales process above and beyond the value of the products and services? Mm. Meaning, if you're not creating value, I don't need you there. They can learn about, you know, buyers today can learn more online or from ChatGPT in 5 minutes about your company than you showing up to be walking, talking, presenting brochure. So value is created with insight, helping clients or prospects to think differently about their issues. You know, that moment where they're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. Or those moments where they say, oh, yeah, I see that. And they're looking at something that's they think is a small issue, but your experience says, oh, you're seeing the tip of the iceberg. Mm. And then you help them to see that. They're like, oh, got it. I see why that's significant. Or a solution they hadn't anticipated. Everybody listening here has had that moment with a client, if you work with clients, where people say, oh, I didn't know we could do that, or that you could do that, or could help us that way. So there's all these ways to demonstrate expertise, to provide insight, and to help clients to think differently. And when you can do that, well, that is part of what sets you apart. That's a sales call your customers might pay for. And when you combine that with a valuable product or service, well, now you're cooking with gas.
It's so interesting. Yesterday, I was on a call. We were looking at a product for our business. And this guy came on, and he was a sales guy, clearly. And he started with telling us about them. and it was a brochure. He gave me the brochure, and I'm like going, I wanted to scream because, you know, I just finished reading the book, and I wanted to scream going, well, I could have read this, man. Come on, let's get to why this is possibly valuable for me or why I would want it. And it's just missed. I mean, look at any website. What do they typically do? They typically tell you why you should hire me, and it's not an interactive, or it's not, you know, doesn't address the problem. You even talk about here, you know, help your customers with problems they don't see. Help your customers with problems they don't know are problems. Help your customers see hidden opportunities. Help your customers find solutions they haven't considered. Help your customers connect with additional resources. And these are just little simple things that you brought up. But where did it get lost? How did we lose this? Going from customer experience to quote unquote customer service. I don't know. How did we lose this?
Well, I think salespeople have long been plagued with a stigma around pitch and tell and not providing much value. So, in fact, I write about that in the book, you know, this idea of the sales stigma that sort of gets in the way of salespeople thinking more about being valuable. You know, I think the real disconnect is that the sales experience never got included in all of the great effort around customer experience and CX. You know, it's sort of like we got on this train about customer experience, but it was almost like it was customer service 2.0. There was no real difference other than some fancy terms. And if you really want to think about the customer experience, you start from the moment they begin to interact with you before they are a customer. All of that effort beforehand, and put as much focus there as you do in the effort after they become a customer. It's probably not about what people are doing as much as what they are not doing. That would be my thought on it.
Yeah, well, there's a part of me.
Just in your take, though, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, I think there's a part of me. We talked about this before the show started. We focus so much on the technique of selling. How do I carve a bit? More scripting. We try to carve out some human hacking techniques. I just heard somebody do the neuro-linguistic programming, words that will make people buy from you, right? And we send people to these ways of trying to be a quote-unquote salesperson versus a customer experience person.
Yeah, this is all of this. So I sort of want to, scream a little bit about that, because if you've heard of Dan Pink, he's a great author, and his book before his last one was called To Sell Is Human. He does a word cloud. I reprinted it in The Growth Leader, with permission, of course. But it's interesting, if you look at the word cloud, of the first thing that comes to people's, and it's pushy and yuck and sleazy. Horrible adjectives that have unfortunately gotten earned by salespeople trying to use tips and techniques to try to manipulate buyers to buy from them. And somehow along the way, we've forgotten about what a friend of mine would call the nobility in sales, Lisa Earl McLeod, who wrote a book about this. But the idea that there is a value in helping to solve problems, helping customers to capitalize on opportunities, helping them to achieve their objectives. And that is, when selling is done well, what it looks like. But for a long time, sales has been sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly judged, pushy, yuck, sleazy, and all those other awful adjectives in Dan Pink's book.
Yeah, aggressive, manipulative, annoying, some of the worthy words that were
used. And I think, you know, those terms are there for a reason.
Right.
Salespeople have employed, they did exactly what you had mentioned a moment ago, right? They use tip and technique to try to get buyers to buy instead of focusing on how, like every other function in a business, how are we valuable? How can we be helpful? Where is the value that we provide?
Right.
You know, and if you can very simply think about that, and not cloud it with all of the technique and tip and style and effort to sort of mask an offer much better.
His name is Scott K. Ettinger. The book, The Growth Leader, Strategies to Drive the Top and Bottom Line Sales. Absolutely outstanding. Get it. Don't wait. Go right now to Amazon. Buy it. It's absolutely outstanding. You're listening to him here on A New Direction. Hey, folks, two sponsors that I got to talk about. First one, of course, is Zoundi. I love it. I was speaking in Salt Lake City a couple weeks ago. And I'm able to give my audiobook away for free to the entire audience, right? Hundreds of people. Give it away. And here's the thing. Unlike other audiobooks that you get, the difference is when they download my audiobook, I get their email address, and now I have an interaction with my reader. Awesome. And I love it. So if you're an author, publisher, whatever it may be, check out Zoundi.com. It's Zoundy.com. Go Zoundi.com/J. Use my code JAY25. That's JAY25. And I'll tell you what, you'll unlock special savings because I got to tell you, this is a great experience. Best thing I've ever done. And I think you'll find it is too. And Linda Craft Team Realtors, let me tell you about them. 40 years helping thousands of people all over transition in life. And you said, wait a minute, I thought they would do real estate. Yeah, but think about it. Every place you've ever lived has been a life transition. They know how to take the stress out of that. They know how to make the process smoother. It's what they've been doing for 40 years, and they've been doing it successfully for people all over the world. So listen, when you're ready to buy, sell your next home, start with the transition expert. Start with Linda Craft Team Realtors. It's lindacraft.com, LindaCraft.com. And we're back here on A New Direction with Scott Ettinger. His book, The Growth Leader, Strategies to Drive the Top and Bottom Lines. Love this book so very much. Read it a couple times. Going to read it again. It's just so dang good. Chapter 2, The Executive's Relationship with Sales. We kind of talked about it. That the bigger the company, especially when we get into the corporate company, there seems to be more distance. I mean, clearly the smaller the company, the less distance, but the bigger the company is, there's a greater distance here. And you have a statistics here, 86% of CEOs are completely or significantly disengaged from or misaligned with sales when it comes to determining the direction of their company. Explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, so by the way, large company, small company, in a large company, the distance is by numbers greater,
right?
Levels, more distinctions in terms of the distance from sales. But philosophically, that distance can be the same in a small company. And there is often a massive philosophical chasm between the C-suite and the sales function, even if that is if they're only separated by two people. And that is typically because executives, CEOs, CFOs, COOs, your triumvirate, the standard triumvirate in the C-suite. They tend to be thinking about the business strategy in terms of what they offer, the efficiency at which they offer it, the financial ramifications of how they offer it in the marketplace. And then it's like sales, just get out there and sell. Tell people how great it is. Of course, that's antithetical to the value that we were talking about beforehand, but most executives, when asked, would say, I just need my sales team to get out there and communicate the value of the offering. They don't talk as much about the value inherent in the sales experience. So there is a disconnect between the amount of time, effort, and energy they put towards strategic interaction with their sales team. In fact, if you look at how CEOs spend their time, but for reviewing forecasts or asking about deal progress, the majority of CEOs spend precious little time involved in anything sales focused that's not an inspection of some kind.
Interesting. Yeah. There, you bring up something in this chapter, and I'm so glad you did. The curse of Glengarry Glen Ross. And if people it is a curse.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen the movie, you know, poor Jack Lemmon, you know? I mean, right, Kevin Spacey, and then of course Alec Baldwin comes in with his briefcase, and don't have to go there. But it's ABC, always be closing, and that's a curse that's kind of gone. I know it's been, it's an older movie, but it's kind of stayed with us, hasn't it?
Well, it has. And we were talking a little bit about this in the reference to the word cloud about sales, you know, and the way people think about sales. And that stigma around sales is stigmatized in the C-suite too, because I'm sure that anybody listening has not thought this about their salespeople, right? But a lot of executives, many executives in the C-suite, and I've talked with 1,000 of them, will think about sales as less strategic, less skilled. You know, I don't tend to have my MBAs there. I've got, you know, all of the best and the brightest at my headquarters. You know, we're using AI, everything from AI to big data and analysis. And I've got marketing, you know, more strategic on brand and finance working the balance sheet and operations driving our efficiency. And salespeople just need to go be personable.
Mm.
So there is a sense that, and again, I'm sure that nobody listening has ever done this, that executives might just look down on the sales function. They know they're critical. By the way, there's not a single executive I've ever talked with that has said sales is anything but vital, critical to the organization. It's viewed as critical, but not strategic. And this is a huge factor in how sales is led, managed, and that perspective that it's critical but not strategic, not a strategic function, influences dozens of decisions made by executives throughout the organization, even if it's a small one, about sales, from who you recruit, how they're managed, how they're developed, how they're deployed, how they're compensated, you name it. So that perspective, that stigma about sales, and the sense that this is not really my strategic function, is a miss, and it influences a lot of counterproductive decisions.
There's something else you bring up here that really struck me very, very hard, and that was habit and persistence. And, you know, I'm a mindset coach, right? And my philosophy with business is that you don't have a business problem, you just have a personal problem that infects your business. Because that's typically what I find, is that it's personal.
That's good.
And it's an infection. And so that's kind of my coaching philosophy in a nutshell. But I hear, you know, my CEOs say to me, oh, I'm an open mindset. But when it comes to the sales stigma of habit, they continue to do the things that they've always have done. Even if there's another better way, they're not open to changing that. All of a sudden they get closed-minded. Do you see that too, as you go into bigger corporations where there's this, we're sending them to the same sales training that we've always sent them to, but nothing's really changing?
Yeah. You're on a hot button topic for me. I'm gonna try to stay calm here. But, you know, when I think of when I work with clients on culture, I wrote this definition in the Growth Leader for Culture: the beliefs that shape behavior. You're talking about mindset. We could you know, sort of swap out words there. But the beliefs that shape behavior. So how the organization thinks about sales, strategic or not strategic, you know, critical but not strategic. How we think about sales goes a long way to informing the decisions we make about the sales organization. And when it comes to training, you know, early in my career, I spent a half a dozen years in the sales training industry. A little more than, I think it was 7. I got out of that business. I joke with clients that it is the most frustrating business on the planet because salespeople would go to programs and after programs say, this is great, but there's 2 things here. Number one, way harder than anybody thinks it is in my company. And second, I'm not managed this way. This is not the way my company treats me. They treat me like I've got to go hit a number, a quota, and that's all that matters. And not the strategic pursuit of the right business, not in any kind of consultative process. So the disconnect between sending people to some sales training island for a few days every year and hoping they come back as fundamentally different sellers, which executives always expect, and yet salespeople come back and say, yeah, I could try this, but that's not how I'm being led and managed. Number one, failure.
Lisa McLeod, who you alluded to, wrote a book called Selling with Noble Purpose. Great book.
She's, I was trying to figure that I mentioned the nobility in sales. Her book name slipped my mind.
No worries. Got you back, brother. Got you back here. She says here, leaders often believe if they can engrave the right words into the hearts and minds of their salespeople, their team will finally be able to sell the full value of their solution.
Yeah.
And yet her research indicates that it's about purpose, not about the money, not about the words.
Yeah. So I co-authored a Harvard Business Review article with Lisa earlier this year on compensation. The working title of that was that compensation is a poor substitute for leadership.
Mm.
And when it comes to sellers, there is this wish on the part of executives. When executives say, I need them to go sell the value, what executives usually mean when you get behind what they're saying is, I need them to go tell customers how valuable our stuff is and tell them all about that. They're not usually talking about the sales experience as a vehicle to create insight and to deliver expertise and subject matter expertise. So that is a miss. And this is a huge factor in that disconnect. Because that is usually what executives mean. If you're an executive that's listening here and you're thinking about, well, what do you want your salespeople to do differently? The thing I hear so often is that I want them to be more consultative. Like when I talk with CEOs about this, that's what I hear. My people need to be more consultative. But then when you start to find where their frustrations are, when they're talking about consultative, they're usually meaning ask a couple of questions and then tell.
And that's not it, because there's no experience. There's no customer experience in that. Because if I'm just telling you things, that what's the experience that I'm getting as the customer?
Yeah, you're on it. And here's the potential miss. If you're a CEO that's listening to this, you could think, well, that's because my salespeople need to do something differently. And you'd be half right about that. But the reason your salespeople are doing that, are not behaving the way you want them to, is because of the way you are leading them and the way the organization is structured. And that is the other half of the equation that is the more important variable. Because salespeople are doing, most of the time, few exceptions, what they think is the right thing to do to make their number. They're doing that and they're showing up to work each day thinking this is, very few sellers show up to work each week thinking, okay, I'm going to do things that the boss does not want me to do.
Right.
I'm going to try to do that. So the real issue is upstream. How are you leading? How are you defining the role of sales in your organization? How are you connecting them to strategy? Because it's real easy to diss on salespeople. And by the way, a lot of them deserve it. They don't do the things that you want them to do. They're frustrating. They're prima donnas, and they're not behaving in the way you want them to. I know. But the issue lies further upstream. That's a symptom, not the cause.
Yeah. It really goes back to my little mantra, right? You don't have a business problem. You really have a you problem as a leader. Yeah,
it's true.
Your sales... You as a leader are infecting negatively your sales because of your leadership.
Yeah. It's, when I'm, again, it's really easy to diss salespeople because let's face it, they so often deserve it. There's tons of room for improvement. And there's a lot of times they are not doing the things you would want them to do. Like I think CEOs would be shocked if they went on sales calls in their company, and sort of the kinds of prospects that your sellers are putting time, money, effort, and energy in pursuing that you'd be like, no, I'd never want them to pursue that. I mean, I'd rather them, do nothing than get that customer. And then what they do with the customers that are your ideal client profile and how they botch those opportunities, you'd be equally shocked. But you have to ask, why are they behaving that way? Why is the world occurring to them to take these actions instead of the actions that you'd want them to? And my hypothesis on this is usually, well, How is your organization structured? How have you defined the role of sales? How are you measuring, managing, deploying, compensating, all of these things? And this is all back to what you talked about, mindset. How do you conceive of the role of sales? What do you think about it?
Yeah, so good. I could just sit here and listen to you talk all day. By the way, I don't even want to ask any questions. I just want you to talk. And
you're kind. Well, it's your job. You're the podcast host.
I'm the host. I know I'm the host. I just want to listen. That's all I want to do. I don't even want to ask you questions. I just want you to go. Just keep going. I don't want to. But I do have to ask this because
you don't want to do that.
I know I do. I'm going to jump to chapter four. It's called the Five Flag Start, this is so cool because. Again, you use analogy of, car racing, right? We have the different flags, right, that let us know when it's time to start, and you have this five flag start. Mm-hmm. And so you said it's a signal, should get everybody started together, headed in the same direction, and moving towards the same strategic goals and at the right time. And so a single flag won't do the job, as you pointed out, so you divide it into five. So I want to go through the five flags, and then I just want you to go ahead and kind of give us a brief overview. You open for that?
Absolutely. Okay. Let's go.
Flag one. There's the first flag. What defines success? What do we mean and what are we talking about here?
Yeah. Before I do that, I'll say the five flags start, if you're listening, is a strategy framework. And my take here is that any good strategy is going to answer a handful of critical questions. I have five of them. But if you Google strategy frameworks, there's thousands of them, right? And some of the things that I mention are, you'd find the common elements of a few things in any good strategy model. And then there's a couple of things that are unique here. But most importantly, we're saying you answer these five key questions about your business, you're going to have a good, solid strategy. So the first one, what defines success? Most organizations I work with do not have a singular objective. They might have one in like a financial goal, a revenue target or something, but usually from a strategy perspective, it's not just one. It's typically a handful, a small handful of critical objectives that when put together create a very vivid picture of what success looks like. So it might be a combination of a revenue target, but if a revenue target is achieved absent the right kind of customers, so making sure that you're winning your share of a particular kind of customer profile. Some companies are very serious about their organizational culture. So it's like, well, if we got the revenue target and the profit number, but we ground our people to a nub, then that's not going to work. So we got to have some kind of employee engagement. So it's usually a small handful, 2, 3, 4 measures of success that would say, this is what good looks like. So we start with the end in mind. What are we aiming for? At the end of the year, we will be thrilled, giddy, if we hit these objectives.
Mm, good. And flag two, and I love this one because I'm a hockey fan here in Carolina, and I know you're a Tampa guy, and you guys have won a lot of Stanley Cups. We got one, okay? One. You have a bunch. We've been around a lot longer. But flag two, what is your power play? Oh, so good. Dig into this a little bit.
Yeah. By the way, I'll say on flag one, nothing revelatory about that, but the specificity and the precision is what is important in that. Your objectives, what defines success. Okay. Flag two, the power play. I took this term from hockey. In the last 2 seconds, you now know as much about hockey as I know. There's a thing called a power play. I didn't really know much about it. I've learned though, because in Tampa, we do have our Stanley Cups to celebrate.
Yeah, you do. You got three of them.
So if you're not familiar, a power play, and by the way, I learned it's also not just in hockey, it's in lacrosse, mm-hmm. and someone told me after the roller derby. There you go. So it is an advantage. It is a numerical advantage you have on the field, on the rink, on the ice, wherever you're competing, where you have an advantage over the competition, and you are much more likely to score and win when you are on your power play. So in business, saying you likely have a reason, a couple of reasons, maybe three reasons, probably not more than that, why customers choose you. Not the long list of marketing brochure kind of commentary that you would say about your business, but why customers choose you in the face of competing alternatives. What is it? That's your power play. In the NHL, teams that are on their power play outscore the competition 300%, three times more likely to win. So I'm saying get really clear on your power play. And most importantly for you CEOs here, make sure that that power play is showing up in every interaction with prospects and customers. Make sure it comes to life. But you got to be crystal clear about that and not lots of vague terms. I see lots of marketing ease on these sort of things. That's the key.
And your power play could be your customer experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I made an additional consideration for that later, but absolutely. In fact, we could say, you know, if the power play is part of your competitive advantage and the customer experience is part of your competitive advantage, well, there's more you have to do with that. I'll get to that in a second. But getting really defined, like so many companies are vague about this. They use marketing speak. They make me nuts about it. It's so boring and corporatese. You've got to get precise and put the rigor behind saying, when we win, this is why we win, and we're going to leverage the heck out of it.
His name is Scott Edinger. The book, The Growth Leader, Strategies to Drive the Top and Bottom Lines. So good. Get yourself a copy. I've abused his. I'll probably have to get another one because it's just covered in dog-eared and yellowed and everything. I just highlighted the heck out of it.
This is great praise from you, Coach Jay. I appreciate it.
You can't find a page in this book where there's not yellow. I mean, it's like this is what the entire book looks like, folks. I don't know if you can see it out there, but it's nothing but yellow. is what it is. You're listening to here on A New Direction. Hey, folks, my sponsors, I love them to death, and I'm grateful for them. Zoundy, absolutely game changer for authors, publishers, and anybody in the audiobook space. Here's the thing. A lot of audiobook companies out there, what I love about them is I have a code, QR code. People can get my book for free when I'm speaking somewhere. They download it. I get their email, I get to interact, find out what they like about the book, what they didn't like about the book, what they'd like to see me write, like what they'd like to see me talk about later. It's just perfect. So listen, check out zoundy.com. It's zoundy.com. Use my code. Just go to zoundy.com/J. Use my code JAY25. That's J25. You'll unlock special savings. And Linda Craft Team Realtors, 40 years in the business, helping people all over the world, privately owned, unaffiliated with any national company. They do outstanding work, known as the legends of customer service. But what really, I'll tell you, their website is amazing. One of the best things about looking at what they do, they actually have a child psychologist write a post about how to move with children. A veterinarian came in and how to move with pets. Just little things that just separate and make a difference. They'll make a difference for you when you're ready to buy or sell your home. Check them out, lindacraft.com, LindaCraft.com. And we're back here on A New Direction with my friend Scott Edinger, the book, The Growth Leader, outstanding book, Strategies to Drive the Top and Bottom Lines. And we're here in the last segment going through the five flags, five start flags. We're at flag number three. We've gone through the first two flags, and for those of you who are just playing at home, the first flag was what defines success. Second flag is what is your power play. The third flag is who will value your power play. Let's talk All about right. that.
So I said you got to get rigorous and defined about what that power play is, how you win in the why you are selected in the face of competing alternatives. The next step in that is say, okay, who is going to select you? Ideally, because you know, I mentioned to you earlier, I'm here in Atlanta. I've been working with a financial institution. So you can imagine a financial institution has an entire universe of customers, potentially. But there is a slice of the market that this organization is just perfect for. And I suspect, if you're listening here, that you could say, yeah, there's a huge market that's available. You know, you hear this term of total available market, which is usually a misnomer. It's usually an inflated number. But if you're saying there is an ideal client profile in the market that is most likely to value the kinds of things that we are great at, and they're willing to pay for it. That's the slice of the market you want to be active in pursuit and targeting, and put all of your time, effort, and energy into going after. So getting really clear on who will value our power play, who is our target market, who are these people, and making sure that from an organizational standpoint that you are marshaling your resources in active pursuit against that part of the world, right? Again, CEOs would lose their mind if they knew how much waste they had in their organization pursuing business that is wildly outside the range of the kind of business they'd really want in the name of being opportunistic. I'm all for being opportunistic if it's easy to acquire and easy for you to implement. But outside of those two criteria, it really ought to be who will value your power play. What do they look like? Where do they live? And to go after them.
Yeah, there's demographics and psychographics, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a big part of it.
Yeah, we can't eliminate one or the other or use just one or the other. You got to know them both. It's incredibly important. Okay, flag four. How does our sales experience create value?
Yep. The forgotten child in the customer experience world, the sales experience. So if flag two is about your competitive advantage and your power play, what you offer, what are the reasons why prospects and customers would select you in the face of competing alternatives, then flag four is about how you offer it. Specifically on the sales experience, though, when I work with clients, I have a handful of them that will say, that will put together sales and customer relationship experience, or sales and CX, recognizing that they want to put them together. But in the book, I highlighted sales only. I did that because it is conspicuous by absence in every strategy. And here, if you decide to apply it and you add client experience to that or customer experience, I'm happy. Go for it. Change the book. But I put it there because, as I mentioned, it is an afterthought when it comes to strategy. And here, I'm sharing with all of you who are listening and anybody who will read the book that the sales experience and the value-creating engine that is your sales team belongs central to your strategy, not as an appendage to it. So here I'm saying, get it into your strategy. I don't care how you do it. I had to go out of my way to say, I'm adding an element to the strategy that's just focused on this.
You have a really powerful final statement in this flag. And I hope people will grab
on. You're going to have to remind me what it
was. Oh, no, it's really good. I want to say it because I'm so giddy about it. So if you want to know how sellers ought to sell, learn how buyers buy. Oh. Sounds so intuitive, but we don't do it.
Yeah, the amount of organizations I work with that will tell me, here's our sales process, and then they inflict that sales process on their customers instead of working with their customers or prospects on what's going to be valuable for them and being flexible with some kind of sales framework. But, very frustrating. And That is a symptom of sales and the sales experience and the sales engine not being part of the strategy.
So beautiful. All right, flag number five. Where must we improve, build, or acquire to execute our strategy?
So to this point, flags one through four in the framework are aspirational. They're probably based on a true story, but they're forward-looking. They're what you want to achieve and how you're going to continue to win or win better and with whom and with what experience, right? The end of the strategy framework, I wanted to create a bridge to execution, to remember that you're not going to get there wherever your strategy is taking you in flag one. You will not get there by declaration. I say this with clients a lot. You just because you write it, just because you've had this, sort of planning effort to create the strategy will not make it so. So you've got to be really serious about looking in the mirror and saying, okay, it's not going to happen just because we said it. What do we need to get better at? And what do we not have that we need to either develop internally or go get? That could be technology, it could be resources, it could be people, it could be another capability, whatever it is. But we're saying here, I want you to answer this question honestly. What do you need to improve, or what do you need to build or acquire if you're going to be able to execute this strategy? And if you do that, then within the strategy, you build a mechanism for execution. That was my goal there.
So good. We're in just the last couple minutes. I'm going to jump to chapter six, one particular piece of chapter six that when I was studying and when I was in grad school and I was fascinated by this, and it was the Yerkes Dodson law, which we call the inverted U theory. But you put it in a great perspective when it comes to sales and leadership on balance, pressure on performance. Can we give just a couple minutes to that? Because it's so, I think, imperative for leaders, sales managers, to understand how this Yerkes-Dodson inverted U theory, how pressure can actually decrease your performance, not increase it.
Yeah. Well, if you're listening here, I'd say imagine a bell curve. And we talk about stress. Stress can be really amazing. It can be motivating, it can be energizing, and it can be debilitating. And if you think about a bell curve, the optimal point of stress is actually at the top of the bell curve. And we'll call there's a technical term for it called eustress. But if you're on the bell curve, on one side you have no stress, well, that's not helpful for a team either. If you have no stress, there's no energy, there's no motion, there's no like, hey, we got to get some action here. But if you have too much stress, which is where leaders tend to put too much stress on their sales team, then that's what causes people to choke. You know, you've heard in baseball, people get the yips, or golf, you know, I think it's golf or baseball, they get the yips, or, people can't focus, or they're trying to close a client. By the way, what feels more obnoxious than a seller trying to close you when you're not ready to buy something, right? So we do all these things to motivate bad sales behavior. The thing I'd tell you as a CEO, senior executive, sales manager, whoever's listening here, think about the optimal level of stress, right? You want some level of pressure in the form of excitement, energy, desire to achieve, an intensity around getting better. But too much stress, you got to make the sale, you got to make this quarter, you got to close the deal, or your job is on the line. Well, that may be true. I don't know that it's going to help your team perform better.
Yeah.
So you got to be really careful about managing the stress level of the organization, of your team, and on the individuals on your team.
Awesome. We've done our hour. You've been outstanding. This has been a lot of fun for me. I hope you've enjoyed it too.
Yeah, it's been great.
Tell people if they want to hire you, coach, speak, how can they get a hold of you to do that?
Yeah. Yes, coach. Yes, speak. Yes, consult. You name it. It's part of what I do. So I'd love for you to come to me. I'm easy to find. It's my name, scottedinger.com, scottedinger.com. Lots of stuff on the website, 100 free articles from Harvard Business Review, Forbes, other places, chief executive. I also have a deep dislike of social media, but I do go to LinkedIn with some frequency. And I'd love for you to find me there. I put posts up about every week or so. I usually try to make it something of value, an article or something like that. I try not to, you know, be one of those posting all the time, you know. So you got to follow me if you want to get those, you know, because I'm not going to just show up in your feed that way. But yeah, find me if you have a question, if you want to talk about the book. And if you buy the book on the website, there is an opportunity to get the free companion workbook.
Cool.
So go grab that. I think all you have to do is it's on the books page for the growth leader, and you can grab a copy of that there.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Stay with me, Scott. Folks, this is the show. You know what I say to you every week? You're in control of three things: your attitude, your effort, and your resiliency. Life doesn't give us what we want. Oftentimes, circumstances come at us from nowhere. But you're still in control of your attitude. Take control of it, because it's within your power. Your effort is tied to your excellence. I know we don't always have the same amount of energy in the tank, but how excellent will you choose to be today? Take control of that. And we all get punched in the gut or punched in the teeth and get knocked down. But you know what? It's up to you to get back up again. And we need you to get back up. Why? Because you're worth it and we want you on the team. You know what? We had a lot of choices. You chose us. Thank you so much. Give us thumbs up on YouTube. Wherever you listen to the show, 5-star positive reviews always help us out. I thank you so much. You know what I say to you all over the world? And that is this. Ciao, everybody. Things are gonna change. You can find the strength to go a different way, yeah. The time has come. Your dreams will take you places you have never